Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The parents of Terry Schiavo vow to take their case to the Supreme Court. This after a second federal court, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, ruled against them early today, refusing to order that Terry Schiavo's feeding tube be restored. A new ABC poll today shows that an overwhelming number of Americans, 70%, believe it was inappropriate for Congress to get involved in the Schiavo decision. State judges had already ruled that Terry Schiavo's husband, Michael, should have the final say in her care when Congress passed legislation this past weekend calling for further judicial review. So where does the case go from here? Jonathan Turley is professor of law at Georgetown University. And Jonathan, first of all, tell us what the federal appeals court said. We know it was a 3-judge panel. They voted 2-1 against the parents' request. But what did they say in doing that?
Well, the majority on the panel agreed with the trial judge that the scope of review of this case is narrow. The question is whether the constitutional rights of Terry Schiavo have been violated, particularly with regard to her due process rights. They agreed with the trial judge that there is no basis to believe that they have been violated, and thus there is no basis to grant the emergency measure requested, that is, the reinsertion of the feeding tube. Now, this is a great controversy with Congress, because many members are quite upset, including Tom DeLay. They believed that what they were requiring was a full factual hearing, that the trial judge would look anew at this whole issue of a persistent vegetative state, the whole issue of who is speaking for her. That is not what the federal courts have done. That is not how they view this legislation.
Right. In fact, those two judges who ruled against the parents said this is a tragic situation, but pre-existing and well-established law must be applied. And the one who ruled in favor of the parents but who lost in the final decision said that failing to restore the feeding tube frustrates Congress's intent, which was, as you said, to maintain a status quo while considering all of these issues.
Yeah, the problem here really is that the bill, the Terry Schiavo bill itself, is hardly a model of clarity. It refers to what's called a de novo review, which means a review that essentially states it starts anew. But the interesting thing is that if the trial court read the law to believe that a full factual hearing was required, he very well could have struck down the law as unconstitutional. That, you know, that type of negation of prior rulings raises serious constitutional questions. At the end of the day, I think the largest problem in the case has always been that Congress can't do what Congress would like to be done. And that is, they can't change the outcome. At the end of the day, you can add procedures, you can add hearings, but only one person will make this decision, and that's Michael Schiavo. The Constitution and the common law protects his right to make the decision. So the only way to change the outcome is to change Michael Schiavo's mind, and that's not going to happen.
And as you said, just to reiterate, Congress was hoping, at the very least, to buy time to have all of these constitutional questions raised and heard, which would have meant reinserting the feeding tube so that Terry Schiavo would remain alive for, I would imagine, quite some time while those issues were debated again.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, the usual tendency for courts is to stabilize the case by stabilizing the patient. There's an inclination to do that. However, the federal judges here have said, you know, that's really the merits of the case. That is, they're not blind to the motivation behind the legislation. That is just to try to delay. If the feeding tube was reinserted, appeals could go on for 2 years. Mm. And so the court was not willing to do that and said, you know, I can say right now at the outset that there is no real federal claim here, that you're not going to prevail. And the Court of Appeals agreed with that.
So now the case having gone through the federal courts and exhausted the appeal on its way to the Supreme Court, how do you expect the Supreme Court will handle it?
I doubt seriously that the Supreme Court is going to reverse this series of decisions. First of all, I think many of these justices will not like how this case came to the courts, and I think one of them could very well be Chief Justice Rehnquist, who does not like political interventions. But, you know, it should concentrate the mind that you now have over a dozen state and federal judges all coming to the same conclusion. The law is quite clear here. There's not uncertainty. There's not fluidity. federal judges do not like this type of political intervention. That was clear from the trial judge, who delayed this hearing until the afternoon following the bill, and said that he was not going to rush to judgment. A lot of judges view this as sort of a bum's rush for the federal courts, you know, that you've got to rule fast, and you got to rule the way we want you to rule. That's not a good thing. It runs against the grain of an Article III judge. But the other problem here is that the law is not uncertain. There is a tendency to suggest that there is some great fluidity or uncertainty in the law. There's not. The tragedy of this case is the division on the family. Are many of these allegations going back and forth? But the law itself is not unclear. Mm-hmm. That's why over a dozen judges in Florida have ruled uniformly for Michael Schiavo, and now the federal judges. And for people that have said that this is tyranny of the judiciary, it really has to concentrate your mind that you have all these state judges and now all these federal judges who are saying there's no case here.
If the parents' appeal to the Supreme Court fails, what other avenues do they have?
They don't have many avenues unless the state wants to try again to pass some legislation. There's discussions that maybe they will try to pass yet new state legislation. The whole purpose of state legislation, quite frankly, is not to create a viable claim. I don't see a viable claim here, but rather to create some uncertainty to get that feeding tube back in. And it'll take so long to defeat the legislation that the tube will be in and another round of appeals will follow. I don't know of any viable way for the state to intervene because I don't see how they can change the law in the area without violating the Constitution. I mean, if they try to strip Michael Schiavo of his right to speak for his wife, they're going to run into a host of common law and constitutional authority that says you can't do that.
How has this case split Congress and split the Republican Party?
Well, the Republicans were fairly uniform in their support for the Terry Schiavo law, though not all Republicans voted. The Republican leadership has made this a very significant issue, and they have not shied away from it. I think that some members have been surprised by the polling that has been done that shows that Americans are not overwhelmingly in support of Congress, that indeed a very significant number of Americans are disturbed or opposed to Congress's intervention. I just did a piece today in USA Today talking about that, and you know, recalling that in my own case, my father passed away a few weeks ago, and we had the same issue. I happen to agree with Terry's parents, but I do not think that it's appropriate to intervene in a family dispute.
I want to ask you about that, Jonathan, because I actually heard you speak about that on the BBC. First of all, I'm sorry for the loss of your father. What was the issue in your family?
My father passed away from complications of Parkinson's a few weeks ago. He had a living will, and he actually stated in his living will that I would help my mother make the decision as to whether he should be terminated in such a case. And it tore our family apart, quite frankly. There were kids that wanted to see all assistance terminated, and there were kids that wanted to see more efforts done.
And what did you want?
I wanted a feeding tube put in, and I think it surprised some of my closest family members. But I was not convinced that more could not be done. And it was a terrible, terrible thing for my family, which is very, very close. And it shows, even with the closest family, how this can tear you apart. And we are still the walking wounded. Those wounds have not healed. Mm-hmm. And for my father, we were actually at the point in his room with him. And I was arranging for a transfer to a hospital with the possible introduction of a feeding tube when he started to fail. And I asked the doctor to leave, and he literally died in my arms. And I have to say, you know, my father was my best friend in this whole world. And I was profoundly sad, obviously, as he slipped away. But silently, I was also profoundly grateful that he took this decision away from us. It was as if he was saying, he's going to save his family and take the decision back. But, you know, having gone through that experience, I am confident of one thing, and that is we would not have been helped by having 300 million people in the room with us. We had a hard enough time with five children in the room. And whatever injuries we caused, whatever self-inflicted injuries we caused to ourselves, they were our injuries. They were our decisions. And that makes a big, big difference.
And yet, I find it so interesting, Jonathan, that here you are arguing for the law, but sympathizing with the parents.
That's right. I mean, I happen to think Michael Shive was making the wrong decision. But, you know, there is a rule of law that governs these cases. You can't change the law because you disagree with how someone is deciding. And, you know, I'm not too sure where we would go if we changed the law. We would be left on a slippery slope, but a complete chaotic environment as to who will ultimately speak for an individual. The law is clear that person must be the spouse. It's not the best thing in the world, but it's the best thing that we can come up with after decades of litigating these cases. What I am perfectly and absolutely certain of is that Congress had no legitimate interest here, that it violates core constitutional principles of federalism. But more importantly, it's an outrageous intrusion into a family dispute. There are thousands of people in analogous positions, including my late father. And Congress and the president have said that this is not going to be precedent, that they're not going to do this in other cases. And the question is why? In those cases, you have the same types of lives in the balance, the same suffering, the same disagreements. Why is it only an intervention in one case? And the answer to me seems to be that it is political, that, you know, the framers once actually used to speak of the term the body politic. You heard that a lot, the body politic, the interest of the body politic. Well, Terri Schiavo has literally become the body politic. Mm. She has become this object lesson. She is more personified than person. And I find that just horrific as someone who just went through this with my own father.
I was going to say, even if in that desperate moment you wanted to get a feeding tube into your father and Congress would have helped you, even then you would not have made that, you know, that trade.
That's right. And even then, even though I was named in living will and I disagreed with my siblings, I would never have gone to court. I mean, at the end of the day, a family had to decide. I would never have gone to court, and I certainly would not have gone to Congress. I'm now a father of three boys and soon a girl, and, you know, part of your job as a parent is prepare your children for this moment. And I think that one thing you teach them is whatever fights you have, you got to deal with it as a family, even if there's lasting wounds. Mm. I find the intervention of Congress to be perfectly horrific.
Jonathan Turley teaches law at the George Washington University Law School, and as we just heard, has had a close personal connection with the Terri Schiavo case. And Jonathan, we thank you for sharing that with us. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, just ahead, editorial writers weigh in on the Schiavo case. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The slow murder of Terri Schiavo. The Schiavo case, a shameful affair. And Congress abuses its influence. These are some of the highly charged words found on editorial pages around the country this week, adding to the debate in Congress and in the courts over the Terri Schiavo case. We spoke to several editors and asked them to read from their pages. We start with Kevin Ann Willey, editorial page editor of the Dallas Morning News. She tells us that the Schiavo case was a difficult topic for the paper's editorial board.
We have one board member who feels very strongly that the president and Congress was correct in doing what they did, and that this woman's life deserves any form and all forms of protection that are available. The vast majority of the board, however, felt this is a, you know, enormously challenging and difficult decision none of us wants to find ourselves in, but that in this particular instance, Congress and the president, though well motivated, have only made a difficult situation even more difficult. The editorial is headlined, Life and Death with Dignity. Intervention makes tragic situation more so. Like the President and Congress, we share the heartbreaking reaction to this case that makes intervention seem appealing. The Schiavo family has begged to become Terry's guardian, but her husband has not only refused, but also succeeded in having her feeding tube removed, a seemingly cold move. As most parents would, Terry Schiavo's mom and dad hold out hope, no matter how unrealistic, for their daughter's recovery. It's doubtful, however, that federal intervention has done more than complicate a family tragedy. In Florida, numerous judges in various courts have issued rulings upholding Michael Schiavo's decision. Across the country, state laws generally support the authority of a spouse to make such crucial decisions for a partner. Moreover, this is a worrisome precedent for congressional intervention into cases in which families and state courts should have the final word. Regrettably, this situation has turned into a debate over which family member has most standing or possesses the purest motive. We conclude with this line, death, like life, should be with dignity.
This is Melanie Kirkpatrick, Associate Editor of the Wall Street Journal editorial page. We struggled with this issue, actually. These are private matters best left to the families and their doctors and their clergy. And generally, we think regulation of such social issues is best left to state legislatures and interpreted by state courts. It's an extraordinary step for Congress to get involved. But the bill was very narrowly crafted to apply solely to Terry Schiavo and not intended to create a precedent. But the thing we noted in the editorial and spent a lot of time on was what we saw as perhaps hypocrisy among liberals on the issue of federalism. Liberals are only too happy for the federal judiciary to get involved when it comes to abortion, homosexuality, and other social issues that they don't want to trust to local communities and to state legislatures or state courts. But in the Terry Schiavo case, they finally discovered federalism and say, hands off. The editorial is called Terry Schiavo and the Law, and I'd like to read an excerpt. The right to die has become another liberal cause, part of the privacy canon that extends through Roe v. Wade on abortion and Lawrence on homosexuality, and also the Ninth Circuit views on assisted suicide that the Supreme Court is taking up this year. Of course, it gets a little messy when someone is actually being killed, and a husband with a conflict of interest is the one who claims she wanted to kill herself. But the left apparently believes that these are mere details that shouldn't interfere with the broader cause, thus the discovery of federalism. Terry Schiavo's case is a tragedy for her and her family. Beyond the immediate question of whether she lives or dies, her case may well have the salutary effect of demonstrating to the elites who want the right to kill oneself embedded into law that there is another side to the debate that is going to be heard.
I'm Ed Williams. I'm editorial page editor of the Charlotte Observer in North Carolina. The headline on our editorial, which ran Tuesday, is Terry Schiavo's Fate. Let me read you a couple of paragraphs of it. There may be no right medical or ethical answer in the case of Terry Schiavo, but there is a right way for politicians to behave. They should make the law governing such difficult situations and then let it work. The refusal of some elected officials to do so is politically opportunistic meddling at its worst. Members of Congress in particular should be ashamed. This is plainly a matter for state law and the courts. Congress has no responsibility or authority. Yet, as one legal expert said, Congress is saying no matter how final a matter is, no matter how settled it is in a state court, we can tell you to go back and redo it in federal court. Then we concluded by discussing the conflict between Terry Schiavo's husband and her parents. Good people differ about what Terry Schiavo would choose and what those who love her should choose for her. But ours is a nation of laws. In the end, emotional and political conflicts must be resolved by law.
I'm Andrew Klein, editorial page editor at the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. The title of our editorial is Killing Terry Schiavo, Where Are Defenders of Women's Rights? Here's how the editorial started. For those who advocate killing Terry Schiavo, the brain-damaged Florida woman whose husband is hell-bent on ending her life, we have a question. Why not just shoot her? For that matter, why not stab her, slit her throat, or suffocate her with a pillow? What's the difference? She'll be no less dead if her husband does any of those things than if she starves to death after he removes her feeding tube. But there is a difference, isn't there? The point we were making here is that Terry Schiavo is very much alive, so removing her feeding tube is not the same as flipping the off switch on a life support machine. it would be similar to smothering her with a pillow or slitting her throat or shooting her. And when you put it in those terms, we think that most people might come to a different conclusion about what should be done in this case. And then we conclude the editorial this way. But there are the liberal intellectuals and some notable members of the Democratic Party, the party of death, arguing that it's no one else's business if Michael Schiavo, Terry's husband, wants to kill her. These are the same people who claim that conservative opposition to abortion is motivated only by a desire to keep women down. Yet here is a woman who is unmistakably alive, whose husband desperately wants to kill her, and the so-called enemies of women are the only ones taking her side. The National Organization for Women is AWOL on this case. The American Civil Liberties Union is actually working with Michael Schiavo to end Terry's life. Terry Schiavo might be a woman and a disabled person, but she is one the so-called women's and civil rights movements are perfectly willing to sacrifice on the altar of choice.
A sampling of opinions from the nation's editorial pages, and this just in, Terry Schiavo's parents have asked the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals full court to review the decision made by the three-judge panel that her feeding tube not be hooked up again, so the case continues in federal court. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush is doing some fence mending with America's closest neighbors. Bush is meeting with Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin and Mexican President Vicente Fox today at his Crawford, Texas ranch. Today, the three nations announced a new pact to broaden cooperation on security and economic issues. Canada and Mexico have been at odds with the U.S. over the war in Iraq. There are also tensions between the U.S. and Canada because of a ban on Canadian cattle, a four-year disagreement over Canadian lumber exports, and most recently, Canada's decision to stay out of the U.S. missile defense project. Meantime, as we said, immigration and border issues top the agenda with lame duck Mexican President Fox, who will be replaced in next year's elections. Well, joining us to talk about the summit and the shifting political landscape in the Americas is Professor Reardon Rowett. He's Director of Western Hemisphere Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you.
And can you tell us, first of all, briefly, just give us a sketch of what can be expected from the summit?
Well, I think the summit is principally symbolic in that both Canada and Mexico have felt somewhat neglected in the context of North America since 9/11. And the president came into office at the beginning of his first administration claiming to have a very progressive policy with regard to Latin America. Bush and President Fox of Mexico met on one or two occasions. There was a state visit to Washington by the president of Mexico, and we thought things were going to really move along very quickly. Then the tragedy of 9/11 took place. International security issues became dominant, and the commitment to a broader plan to develop North America, Canada, the U.S., and Mexico really fell by the wayside.
Right. In fact, some would say that the Bush administration has taken its eye off of Latin America at a time that is actually very crucial there. We're going to talk more about that, but let's talk about Mexico first and foremost. Vicente Fox, now seen as a lame duck?
I think so. It's a very unfortunate in that President Fox was the first democratically elected president in Mexican history from an important opposition party, but unfortunately he doesn't have a large majority of votes in the National Congress, and he's not been able to really move forward with his reform program. First. Second, many Mexicans believe that the president is more interested in public relations than policy, and that has been a serious problem also.
And that would affect the issue of immigration in particular.
That's the critical question for Mexicans. The Mexican government, the flow of illegal immigrants across our 2,000-mile frontier has now become a source of real concern for the United States. Because of the security issue, but it's always been a real issue for Mexican politicians because of accusations of mistreatment of the Mexican workers in this country, their inability to really gain access to Social Security and medical and educational programs. The issue, though, is that there are more and more Mexicans crossing the border illegally and legally, and I think that will be an important issue in the talks at the ranch.
Well, and now there's speculation that a left-leaning candidate, Mexico City's mayor, could win the 2006 presidential race, replacing Vicente Fox. What would be the political impact on the region if that were to happen?
Well, it would really continue a trend that has been going on for the last couple of years, of electing leaders that we would call socially progressive. The word left is really something from the Cold War, but we keep using it. But they are, in a sense, in contrast to the traditional political elites, they certainly are a good deal more progressive in their thinking about income distribution, about social justice, and about basic reforms that would provide more income for the lower part of the segment of the population in these countries.
But they're not all successful, and they're not all leaning left, if you will, with the same tilt. Can you run through the Latin American countries we're speaking of and name their leaders, and we'll tick through them?
Well, the most important is President Lula, as he's called in Brazil, very important spokesman for, again, this progressive position in terms of social reform, but with a very conservative fiscal stance, which is, I think, a very important difference from the past when budget surpluses really didn't seem to matter to political leaders, and they do now. President Kirchner in Argentina, very interesting candidate, a surprise candidate for the presidency, who too has taken a somewhat different position on dealing with the international financial institutions, but is maintaining a very conservative fiscal position at home. President Ricardo Lagos, a socialist in Chile, again, very conservative on fiscal issues. And the most important and different leader is President Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who has an extraordinary wealth because of oil income and is progressive both in terms of using the political process to achieve a very broad political base and really attacking the traditional elite in Venezuela.
Well, let's stay with Chavez for a minute because, boy, he has made some pretty strong statements against the U.S.
Well, Chavez is a very colorful figure. He's given to long ranting speeches along the lines of Fidel Castro in Cuba. He indeed has accused the United States and the White House of planning to assassinate him. He is very friendly with Middle Eastern leaders through OPEC, the oil cartel. The president of Iran was just in Caracas, Venezuela, and gave a very, very strong anti-American, anti-imperialist speech in the Venezuelan Congress. Chavez has a radio show, a daily radio show, in which he rants and raves, again, against President Bush, against the United States, against the G7, the group of seven industrial nations, and anyone who appears to be anti-Chavez is therefore anti-Venezuela, and the two, I think, in his mind, are very difficult to separate. He has taken as his symbol Simón Bolívar, who was one of the founding fathers of independent Latin America in the early 1800s, and he has something he calls a Bolivarian revolution in mind, which is power to the people. He's also anti-American, anti-imperialist. He's anti-globalization. He doesn't like what international financial markets do to poor countries. But he's also in the driver's seat because oil, where it is in the high 40s and low 50s, has given him a treasure chest with which to use that treasure chest to build a large popular support in Venezuela.
Well, and perhaps that's why perhaps he hasn't heard more from the U.S. about, let's say, comments about Condoleezza Rice. He's made sexual references to her. He calls her Condolencia, which does that mean condolences, we hear in Spanish?
That's right.
The fact is Venezuela is the fourth largest supplier of oil to the U.S. How big is oil a factor in U.S. relations with Chavez?
Oil is a tremendous factor because the United States has not been able to come up with a hemispheric energy policy that would allow us to reduce our dependence on Chavez and Venezuela. Now, Chavez has not ever stated he would cut off oil exports to the United States, but he is trying to diversify those exports to China, to Asia, to other countries where there is very high demand.
Professor Rowett, before we take a quick break, is Hugo Chavez crazy or crazy like a fox?
I think the general opinion is that he's crazy like a fox. I think he's a superb actor, that he's been able to outmaneuver both the United States, his Latin American neighbors, who would like to see a far more cautious Chavez in Venezuela and in the Americas. And he has certainly been able to build bridges to China and to the Middle Eastern countries that really never existed as dynamically as they do today. He really is, in a sense, a force of nature in the region that we have not seen for many decades, probably not since Fidel Castro in the 1950s and 1960s.
We've been talking to Riordan Rowett, Director of Western Hemisphere Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C., and you're listening to Here and Now. We've been talking about the rise of left-leaning governments in Latin America and the impact on the U.S., and we've been talking to Professor Reardon Rowett of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Professor, some say the Bush administration fails to understand that this new left in Latin America is less Che Guevara than FDR. What does that statement mean to you?
I think it's a fair statement, but it really represents the fact that it's not just the Bush administration, but for a number of years, the United States has really neglected our relationship with the countries in the Western Hemisphere. The last real initiative was the Free Trade Area of the Americas in 1994, and that has not been completed yet. Other initiatives have been left hanging as well. And the most important thing for the new leaders in Latin America, if they are on the left, is the failure of a series of reforms that their predecessors tried to implement during the 1990s, so-called market reforms. Those market reforms were supposed to lead to greater economic growth and therefore more employment, more jobs, more social security for the people in Latin America. That hasn't happened. The numbers are terrible. They're no better than they were in the late 80s and early 1990s.
Some would ask, and we've actually had listeners ask, you know, is this a democracy in Venezuela, much as they ask the same of, let's say, Haiti? And if not, why isn't the U.S. more concerned, as they seem to be concerned about the spread of democracy elsewhere in the world?
The Venezuelan case, I think, is the most tragic of what's happened in Latin America because of the failure of the reform agenda in the 1990s. You know, Chavez is manipulating democratic institutions for his own purposes. He is very close to Fidel Castro in Cuba, which is of concern to the United States. And again, there are suspicions that he is reaching out to more radical leftist groups in Colombia and possibly other countries in the Andean range in South America.
And what would you say the U.S. has to do, you know, to try to maintain economic and political stability in a region that is so important?
There are a number of things I think that we probably should be doing or should have done over the past 10 or 12 years. Certainly, we should try to find an accommodation with the countries in the region over a free trade area of the Americas. The bloc is really agricultural subsidies in the United States, but as you know, that is a very difficult domestic political question for any White House.
It's a political third rail.
A political third rail that goes very far in the U.S. Congress. Mm. Another issue that has been very important is the issue of drugs. The Latin Americans believe the U.S. is blaming them for U.S. drug consumption. There are two sides of the argument. One is production, one is consumption. U.S. position is the problem is the production in South America. Latin Americans increasingly say the real problem is consumption in the United States and Europe, and political leaders don't have the courage to face up to that.
Is there a danger of these countries being pushed deeper into the left, closer to a Cuba-like communism as opposed to the social progressiveness that at least many of them are aiming for?
I think the real danger is in the Andean countries, countries like Bolivia and Ecuador, where we have a very new phenomenon, which are indigenous local Indian populations that have now become organized and galvanized by local leaders who, again, are sound very much like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And it doesn't seem the United States has any policy to really neutralize that movement in those countries.
We began by talking about the summit, the president of Mexico, Vicente Fox, meeting with President Bush at the Crawford Ranch. And yet, Fox is going to be replaced as president in the upcoming election, possibly replaced by a left-leaning mayor. How important is that?
I think very important for the United States and possibly for South America. The mayor of Mexico City, Mr. López Obrador, is a charismatic, young, dynamic civic leader who has done a great job as mayor of Mexico City, an almost impossible challenge. He has also demonstrated a certain rhetoric that could be interpreted as anti-American because the Americans, he would argue, have not moved forward with the agenda set forth by President Fox.
How do you view this new potential president as a future Crawford guest?
I think it would be very difficult to imagine the kind of relationship between López Obrador and President Bush that the Fox-Bush team has put together or put together during the first term of President Bush. López Obrador is viewed, I think, on the left in the region. The fact that the United States has not been able to produce many policy initiatives that would favor the Mexican position in the debate between the two countries would certainly work in his favor during the campaign and, if elected, after his election as president of Mexico next year.
Reardon Rowett, Director of Western Hemisphere Studies at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Professor, thank you.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. First, there was new journalism. It had its heyday in the 60s and 70s in magazines such as Rolling Stone, Esquire, and The New Yorker. Well, now there's new journalism. Here to tell us what's new about new journalism is writer Robert Boynton. He's edited the new journalism, Conversations with America's Best Nonfiction Writers on Their Craft. He's also director of New York University's Magazine Journalism Program, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And could you start with going back and defining new journalism, which a phrase that was coined by Tom Wolfe, although he claims not to like it. Yeah, but what was that?
Well, the new journalism was a movement in the late 60s, early 70s, in which nonfiction writers were able to take a lot of the methods and techniques of fiction writing, novelists in particular, and use them to write nonfiction. And Wolfe sort of blazed a trail for them to take all those skills and desires and funnel them into writing nonfiction magazine writing or magazine articles.
Well, and again, he denies coining the label, even though his anthology of 1973 was called The New Journalism. But some of the new journalists, Truman Capote, In Cold Blood, he wrote about a murder in a way few had.
Sure, he wrote about it as a novel, as did, say, Norman Mailer in Armies of the Night and other sort of seminal works like that.
And we probably lost one of the greater reporters of the genre, Hunter Thompson.
Yeah, Hunter Thompson was one of the great new journalists, and he, you know, probably represented the sort of outer edge, what he called gonzo journalism, which was sort of seen oftentimes as a sub-genre of new journalism in that it sort of takes more liberties with language and reporting and things like that.
So what happened? Was that edge not edgy enough? Now we've got new journalism. How much farther out is the edge?
Well, the new, which is, admittedly a clumsy name, it's more of a reporter's medium than a writer's medium. It's something that takes the kind of faithfulness to facts and interest in real-life situations and drills down more deeply into reality than I think even the new journalists were able to do.
Boy, you're not kidding, drills down. In fact, let's bring into the conversation writer Ted Conover. He's author of the book Rolling Nowhere, that's about riding the rails with hobos. And he also wrote the award-winning New Jack about prison guards at Sing Sing Prison. And Ted, how deep did you drill, for instance, to get New Jack?
Well, when the state of New York told me I couldn't go to work with the guards I'd met and wanted to write about, I thought, okay, I'm going to apply for the job myself. So I did. It took me 4 years to get hired, and then once on the job, I stayed for almost a year.
And the result is the book. Did you ever, I mean, in the time that you were doing that, and time's the operative word, right, Robert Boynton?
Absolutely.
Time spent. Did you ever say, what am I doing? I mean, what if this doesn't pan out? That's a lot of an investment.
It's a huge investment, and it's not just time, it's money, because, I thought the whole thing was so tenuous, I could get fired or injured or discovered practically any day. I was, I guess I was making $24,000 a year as a guard, but I'm so relieved when the day comes when I think, okay, I've got enough, I'm going to go home and write the book. It's a huge relief because, as you say, you're taking a big chance.
Well, some of the other writers that join you in this new journalism as put together by Robert Boynton include John Krakauer, Calvin Trillin, Susan Orlean. Tell us, for instance, some of the things that Susan's done to drill down.
Well, Susan, you know, she's I should say it right off that the new journalism is a something like all movements, something of construction. There's a sensibility, I think, in it, which is made up of many parts. Some of the writers share it more than others. One aspect of it is this expansion of the amount of reporting and the longitudinal expansion, the kind of reporting over weeks and months and years, or the kind of modes of reporting, much like we just saw with Ted, where he spent nearly a year actually working in a prison. So different writers exhibit different aspects. The one that Susan Orlean, I think, best exhibits is this sort of devotion to and fascination with the quotidian, with the everyday, people, places that might not be written about otherwise, such as a beauty parlor or a gospel choir or a cab driver. That exemplifies another aspect of the new journalism.
It's been exciting to read Rob's book because when you're in the middle of something, as I guess all of the writers in this are, you don't always understand the boundaries of it and what's happening. And Rob has, I think, very accurately pointed to a lot of trends that I guess I'm part of.
One of them, if I might just interrupt, is that, Ted is very much part of this tradition of early 19th and even 18th century American literary journalism, the narrative of the young man who goes off to the frontier or goes out and has an adventure and then comes back with the news was an incredibly popular literary form. And one of the other aspects of the new journalism, I argue, is that it's reviving an earlier strand of American literary journalism, and that's one very big aspect of it.
Well, I'm wondering, though, and Ted, I'll ask you directly, what do you say to journalists, reporters who might say, this is self-indulgent? You know, a reporter's never supposed to be in the story. A reporter's not supposed to, you know, take the role of the person they're reporting on. It's all for show, and I'm wondering if you've heard that, and what do you think of that?
It's a sort of a graybeard attitude, I think.
Graybeard.
Yeah, well, it's sort
old.
Of the great Solomons of journalism repeat that sentiment, and I think it's appropriate if you're writing for a daily newspaper when the author's voice is just going to be a distraction, but I put myself in the story only when I think it helps to tell the story. And to me, it's a more truthful way of telling a story. I'm walking into a hobo jungle. You know, my presence there is going to make a difference to everything I see and hear, and I might as well be honest about it, that me being there is going to change what I'm seeing, and it's going to affect what people are saying. Mm-hmm. And in prison, there's no way to tell the story without using the first person. I could just write about what I saw in there, but he would be leaving out this whole aspect of the story, which I don't think I'm alone in finding interesting, of a person who's brand new, who's not a part of that culture, and who's trying to find his way in it. So
I was going to ask you, Ted Conover, give me one fact that came up in New Jack that was an observation you made taking a job as a prison guard that you just would not have known as a reporter.
Oh, that a guard could feel scared and to some degree at the mercy of large numbers of inmates around him or her. I had not known or guessed anything like that about our prison system.
Author Ted Conover, his most recent award-winning book is called New Jack, and he's one of the new journalists profiled in Robert Boynton's new book. And Robert Boynton, just a quick question to you. Are there people who, you know, trying to be new journalists, and, you know, no matter how much time they spend and what they move into and what job they take, there's just something about those that you profiled that is just, you either have it or you don't?
I think that there is a real urge to write about oneself and one's adventures in a memoir-like vein, and that's certainly something that this culture embraces. So I think that, you know, the way, say, Ted or Michael Lewis or Ron Rosenbaum chooses to render their extraordinary reporting is very different from the reporting. As Michael Lewis pointed out to me in one of the interviews, he says he finds himself oftentimes as he's rewriting, taking out himself over and over again, so that what you're left with is only just the most important aspects of himself, and the rest is gone.
The story. Robert Boynton is editor of the book The New Journalism, Conversations with America's Best Nonfiction Writers on Their Craft. Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
And Ted Conover, thank you, and continued success until you're replaced by the new journalists.
Thanks, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.